33, right? He was only 33 years old when he died. He had begun to have his subjects call him divine. This was typical of those ancient kings, is that the more they accomplished, the more they were enamored with themselves, and it was not unusual for them to think that they were descendants of deity. You know, the Caesars did that. Of course, the way back before that, and you got the Egyptian pharaohs, and they did the same thing. So there's nothing real novel about that. But that the sacred text here says that he did magnify himself exceedingly. And he was mighty. And so this large horn, again, horn representing power, and he had tremendous amount of power. And what's amazing is that whenever he conquered a territory, he didn't establish a military post there and keep the people under the gun. And I guess the people were just so overwhelmed by his military expertise that they were afraid to rebel against him because they knew he'd be right back on top of them. I don't know. But for the most part, he didn't set up any real governmental authorities, no system of taxation, no major contingent of military power. He just ran over them and kept on going, and they just kind of, whoa. So it's not surprising then that whenever that horn was broken, Alexander died. Then there were four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. And out of them, that is these four lesser horns, came up a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. That would be I noticed some versions say Judah or Palestine. In fact, the footnote in my Bible says Palestine. That would be the land around Jerusalem, as we would know it. Now, so you see these four little horns, and then this one horn that then comes out of one of those other horns. And verse 10 says, and it grew to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Now that is a big horn. Grows up so tall that it knocks the stars out of heaven and they fall down. The millennialists have a little trouble literalizing this. They're going to have to admit that, that's got to be figurative language because it's a long way to those stars, and that would be a big horn. Oh, me. What do stars typically symbolize?
Higher powers.
Higher powers. Yeah. Leaders, then. Higher powers. Leaders. All right. Host of heaven here seems to point to God's people. And I think that is corroborated, as we'll see in just a moment when we talk about some historical events that seem to fit here. Now, it's kind of interesting when you start reading some of the millennialists, and I've been going back and forth on what I'm going to do with this section, and I've just about come to the conclusion that I'm going to go ahead through it. I'll hit a few millennial points, but after we get all through with it, then I think I'm going to come back and, having gone over the material, having it fresh in our minds, deal with some millennial questions, then how they pervert these scriptures. I've decided that maybe that's going to be a little better way to approach it. So, but we'll bring out a few things as we go along here. So this horn, this big one, did inflict some harm and mayhem upon God's people and some of the leaders of Judah, or God's people. He trampled them down. That is the stars, which would be the leaders of the host of the Lord. And then verse 11, it, now that's, keep in mind, we're still talking about that big horn. There's your imagery over there on the right. Oops. Okay. Now we're up ahead. It, that big horn, magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. Literally, that would be prince of the host, which would be God. God's the sovereign ruler over, in this terminology, the host. So the horn has put himself on the same plane as God. And it, that is the horn, removed the regular sacrifice from him, that would be God or God's people, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground. That is the horn. Again, keep the antecedent of the pronoun in mind, in the context. And perform its will and prosper. So this horn is romping and stomping and disrupting the worship of the host, of God's people, overpowering them, stopping the regular sacrifice, flinging the truth to the ground, and it looks like everything's going real smooth here with this horn getting its way and just running over everything that's right. Now, Brother Harkrider brings out some of the historical events that I'm persuaded point to the one that this is talking about, and that's Antiochus Epiphanes. You can see this map of the, it's called the Maccabean Kingdom. This region that's outlined here was called Coele Syria, C-O-E-L-E, Coele Syria. In the bigger picture, you've got Babylon over here, Medo-Persian, you know, that overthrew the Babylonians. You've got Egypt down here. Now, when Alexander died, they started fussing and fighting over who's going to get control, because there was no heir to the king. One of his wives was 5 months pregnant, but he was still a little bit young to rule. Right? There was sort of a half-breed brother that was mentally retarded that one of the generals said, well, we'll just make him king. Alexander had brought him to Babylon, kind of set him up in housekeeping because he was afraid to leave him in Greece because of what might happen to him. He did care about him. Well, for a day or two, they set him up, but that didn't work. You know, he really couldn't rule. And so four of his generals started vying for power. Well, actually more than four. There were 13. I believe there were 13, if I remember reading. 13 of them were vying for control. The long and the short of it is they wound up splitting it in four pieces. And basically you have the Macedonian segment, which would be back over towards Greek, and then Philippi. And then you come on down towards Western Asia and Turkey, and you've got that region, Asia and Thrace, T-H-R-A-S-E. Then Egypt, and then over in the in Syria and in the east. Okay, this this area here went to the Syrian segment. Okay. However, this region was a political football for a long, in fact, for hundreds of years. Well, you know, we talked about this even in when we were studying Jeremiah. You know, the Babylonians would come down, the Egyptians would come push up. They wanted it. The guys from the north, and back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Well, the guy that finally sort of rose to the top in this region was a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, Rome, there were a lot of dynamics here. Rome was exerting its power. So the Romans wanted Antiochus to pledge allegiance to Rome. Well, he sort of kind of halfway said he would, but what he really wanted to do, he wanted to go down here to Egypt. The Ptolemies, that starts with a P, P-T-O-L-M-E-Y or something like that, the Ptolemies were the controlling rulers in Egypt, but Antiochus had aspirations of taking them over. Well, so he goes down there and he attacks Alexandria, which I think is about right there, as I remember. That's close enough for government work, right? So he attacks Alexander. Well, the word got to Rome. Rome sent an emissary from the Senate down there, and he cornered Antiochus and essentially backed him up in the corner and said, "What do you think you're doing here?" And so he said, "Before I leave here, you're going to say you're going to get out of Egypt." And he hemmed and hawed around, and the guy took a stick and drew a circle around it. And around him, Antiochus was standing there, and he drew a circle around him. He said, "You're not leaving that circle till you say that you're getting out of Egypt, or I'm whacking your head off," you know, essentially. And so Antiochus capitulated. He said, "Okay, you know, have a nice trip back to Rome." Well, he was really outraged because he thought that he had some alliance with some of the Jews back up in here, that they were going to kind of support his efforts against Egypt. And so he was just hopping mad whenever he goes back up towards Jerusalem in this area called Colle Syria. And so he goes storming into Jerusalem. All right. Now, I want to read this now because I don't want to leave anything out. So he marched back up the coast and took his frustrations out on the satrapy of Colle Syria, beginning a purge among anyone who had shown sympathy for the Egyptians' request. Now, the Egyptians are the ones that sent to Rome and said, "Hey, guess what? Antiochus is down here, and he's, you know," and so that's when they sent the guy from Rome down there. This included a good many residents of Jerusalem. Quote, "At the same time that Antiochus, who is called Epiphanes, had a quarrel with the sixth Ptolemy about his right to the whole country of Syria," Josephus says, "he came upon the Jews with a great army. He took their city by force. He slew a great multitude of those favored Ptolemy and spoiled the temple." So, you know, there were sympathizers with Rome, there were sympathizers with Egypt, and, you know, so anyway, Antiochus goes back up there and he's just going to let them, you know, have it. Now, the spoiling of the temple was pure opportunism. Antiochus was broke and he needed sacred treasures. On his pass through Judea, he not only plundered the temple treasury, he butchered a great many of the citizens of Jerusalem. And he also installed a garrison in Jerusalem to keep the Jews loyal. He knew nothing about Jewish religion. His plan for folding the Jews more tightly into the Seleucid fold, by the way, the Seleucids were the general group that had controlling power of this section whenever it was divided up between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and the guys in Macedonia, and I can't remember what they were called, and then the other group. Well, he's trying to keep them all in the Seleucid fold, keeping them out of the Ptolemaic fence. So what he did, he decided he would change the temple cult so that their Yahweh became identified with Zeus. This chief god would then be worshipped as manifest in his own person, Antiochus Epiphanes, the epiphany or revelation of Zeus-Yahweh on the earth. So he forced them to blend their religion, the Jews, to blend their religion with the pagan Zeus, and then he is the revelation of this deity. So in a sense, so now he's saying, you have to worship me because that's, you know, the way it is. So this was a fairly standard mixture of the Greek pantheon with Persian ideas about a king's divinities. Of course, the Jews were just, it was hideous blasphemy. They were outraged. Antiochus wanted them to sacrifice to Zeus in the temple and to celebrate his own birthday as a religious festival. Hey, let's have a party, and guess who? You know, it's my party. The Jews of Jerusalem went into hiding at this, or they had to be flogged into obedience. Antiochus, infuriated by their stubbornness, declared Judaism an illegal religion. Anyone who refused to eat pork when required, remember it was against the Levitical law, dietary restrictions to eat pork. Well, he forced them to. If they didn't, or he found a copy of the Jewish scriptures, he put them to death. Forcing them to eat pork, if they didn't, he would kill them. If they had any semblance of the scripture. By the way, didn't we read something over here about he would cast truth down in our text in Daniel chapter 8? Two women, here's another quotation, I think this one's from 2 Maccabees. Two women were brought in for having circumcised their children. Remember, he had declared Judaism was illegal. These women had sacrificed their sons, so they were brought before him. These women were publicly paraded about the city with their babies hanging from their breast, and then they were hurled headlong over the wall into the ravine outside. This level of savagery lasted for less than a year before a revolt rose up among the Jews, a family of five brothers descended from the old tribe of priests, and the oldest brother, Judas Maccabees, was the one that led the revolt. The fury of the Jews and Antiochus' own difficulties elsewhere prolonged the rebellion, and so this went on for a while, and then at the end of that time, Antiochus Epiphanes died. So, he caused a tremendous amount of misery for the Jews in and around Jerusalem for a certain period of time. Now hold that thought. Let's go back to our text. Verse 12 of Daniel chapter 8. And on account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. By the way, when Alexander had come through this area, he had Hellenized a lot of the priests. They had embraced Greek philosophy. They had embraced the Greek way of life. And most of all, they loved the Greek zeal for the lust of the flesh. So, what we're seeing here is God's use of one to punish the transgressions of the Jews who had given themselves over to the Hellenistic lifestyle. And that's verse 12. And on account of transgression, the transgression of the Jews. That's why God did this to thee. He punished them. Now, going back to verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the particular one that was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the and the host to be trampled. And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. I disagree with Harkrider. I don't know how he arrived at the conclusion he did on that that statement about the time frame of the 2,300 evenings and mornings. Evening and morning is a classic what Hebrew way of defining a day. Genesis 1, evening and morning, day 1, evening and morning, day 2. So, if you were to literalize this, this would be something like 6 years and 140 days. But, in the bigger picture of the symbolism of numbers to the Jewish mind, what is the complete number in this range of numbers? 7. 6 is incomplete. Remember in the Revelation, what was the mark of the beast? 666. Incomplete, incomplete, incomplete. So, my persuasion is, and there are a number of others, but after I taught Revelation the last time, and y'all that were in that class remember how I changed my thinking on some of the symbolism in Revelation, I'm persuaded Daniel's the same thing. For these people, at this point in time, what they would get out of this is that, yes, there is going to be persecution. Yes, it's going to be some kingdoms in the future. I mean, they had never heard of Greece. They had never heard of, most likely, they had heard of Persia, but they certainly hadn't heard of Greece. That wasn't even, we're talking 250 years later. But what they do need to know is, even though there is going to be persecution after the time that they're living in, it's not going to go on and on and on and on. It is a limited period of time. That persecution will come to an end, and God's cause will be triumphant. Of course, we'll get to that. We've already touched on it in chapter 7. We've already touched on it in chapter 2. With the triumphant picture of the destruction of those four kingdoms represented by the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw, by the stone that was cut without hands that came and crushed all those kingdoms in that image, in that dream. And, of course, in chapter 7, the one that came in the Ancient of Days and was given a kingdom that was to never be destroyed, verses 13 and 14 of chapter 7. And then we're going to get to see it again in chapter 9. So these people are being told, yes, there's more trouble coming. Yes, it's going to be in the future. Yes, there's going to be some period of time involved here, but it's going to come to an end that is incomplete in the sense that it doesn't just go on and on and on and on. That's my persuasion in terms of the 2300. If you start trying to make this a literal number of days, you run into no end of difficulty to try to make it come out. Harkrider, he quotes from that other guy. Whatever that guy's name was. You got the book. He obviously took 2,300 and said, that 2,300 mornings and evenings, that would be, two. You would have to divide that by two to get this 3-year period, or short of 3-year, or whatever period of military endeavors of Antiochus Epiphanes. And then he tried. Then you have to tweak it 50 or 60 days, one way or another. I don't think that's the Holy Spirit's intention at all. I think the nature of apocalyptic language is to help the people at that time with something that communicates a broader message to them. Yes, there are specifics, but those specifics are named. And so, I mean, that's my thought on the 2300, that it just means an incomplete, yet there is a definite period of time. And then he says, at the end of it, the holy place will be restored. Now, if you want to make the connection, you can write your notes, and I'm persuaded enough that I've actually drawn lines in my Bible between the last phrase of verse 14. The holy place will be properly restored. The last sentence of verse 17, Son of Man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. That is, the end of this segment of history and God's punishment of the Jews. Because in verse 19 he said, Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. The word indignation, New American Standard, in verse 19, final period of indignation. If you look that up in the Hebrew dictionary, indignation always refers to the outpouring of wrath. In this case, it's the outpouring of God's wrath on His people for their transgression in embracing Hellenism. And God then used, and we'll go back over this next week, God used Antiochus Epiphanes, just like He used other pagans at various times, to punish the people for their transgression. Are we thoroughly confused?
There's no chance that passage there tied into chapter 9 could be what Matthew talked about. Paul talked about the desolation, the abomination of desolation.
Well, I wouldn't say there's no chance, but I don't believe it is. I believe chapter 9 is dealing with the destruction, you know, because Jesus quotes it in applying it to the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, yeah, because Jesus says it is.
That's right.
When you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, yeah, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Right.
But this, you don't think this is by the Bible?
That's my persuasion. But no, it's possible, but at this point in time, I'm not convinced it is. I'm persuaded that this is talking about the period of persecution of the Jews because of their embracing Hellenism and his use of Antiochus Epiphanes to punish them. Well, when we get into the interpretation as it's spelled out here, we can talk a little bit more about that next week. But I know some people take that position, and hey, I'm not going to have falling out with anybody that does. At this juncture, this is the conclusion that I've come to. But I reserve the right to change my mind. Brother Haley makes some pretty compelling arguments in his commentary on Daniel, and so does Jim McGuigan and Brother Harkrider, although I disagree with Brother Harkrider about the 2300. I don't see how he got. Well, he just quotes that other guy that painted that scenario. I don't see how in the world he gets that. I remember talking about Daniel 9. I'm not going to go any further tonight. I remember when I first started studying Daniel 9, and we had Brother Haley for a meeting. And And so I sat down and talked to him about it. Of course, you know, I was just green as a gourd. I definitely didn't know what I was talking about then. But I had studied Rodney Miller's Lion and Lamb on premillennialism, which is a refutation of Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth. And so, man, I was going crazy trying to figure out how you make all those things come out. You know, you make the 70 weeks fit the period of time from whenever the order to rebuild the temple was issued and all that kind of stuff, and then you try to fit the sequence of events from the birth of Christ to the destruction of Jerusalem into all those different numbers, and you can't do it. It is absolutely impossible. Now, the millennialists will hedge and haw and hedge, and actually even some of our brethren will, and they'll say, well, if you just adjust it this way a little bit, if you do this, you know, then you can kind of make it come out. And so I was talking to Brother Haley about that. I said, you know, I'd just come out of the banking industry, so at least I could add two and two. And I said, I've worked on this thing. I've looked at it every which way. And I said, I cannot make it come out. He said, Ken, quit trying. That's not the point. It is not the point to spell out in detail a chronology of historical events. And boy, a little bell went off then. I thought, wow, that sure makes it easy. We don't have to, you know, balance the ledger, you know, balance the account. It's not. But that's what all the millennialists do, is that they come up with some sort of a formula for what a week is, or a year, or a day, and all that. And then they try to make all these things come out exactly to some specific event in history. And that was never the intended purpose. Remember, the nature of apocalyptic language is to encourage the people that are getting the message. That's the initial primary purpose. And, of course, the purpose of Daniel is to remind the people that God is in control. Exactly. So, yes, God's in control, and that even includes punishing his people who rebel against him. But the good news is, that's not the end of the story. Not the end of the historical narrative. There's a brighter day coming, and the hope. And again, it's always a message of hope. Apocalyptic language for God's people who are faithful to him. There is always a underlying, clear statement of hope in that language. Anything else?